My dear friends, the regime in Russia is hostile to religion. Its leaders boastfully avow their atheism. They do not seem to be as rabid today in their opposition as formerly. But everything that the government can do to eradicate it from among the people, short of completely shutting down all places of public worship, is being done. Public worship is permitted, but the number of churches and mosques and synagogues has been drastically reduced under one pretext or another. The noblest of the church edifices in Russia, like St. Basil's Cathedral in Moscow's Red Square, and the Uspensky Cathedral, have been turned into museums. So has St. Isaac's Cathedral in Leningrad, which is the third largest in the world, and the Kazan Church, which is now a museum of religion, or rather of anti-religion and atheism, and the famous Sofisky Cathedral in Kiev. Now, there are many unused churches, and they are being carefully restored to preserve them for their artistic and historic value, if they have any. You see their gilded, onion-shaped domes, newly covered over with bright gold, glistening in the sun. But this should not lead anyone to the conclusion that the Russian communists have repented and are changing their views on church and religion. They're not. All religious instruction is still strictly forbidden, except where a parent teaches his own child. And this has been going on for more than 40 years, so that the present generation of Russians has grown up not alone without any positive religious instruction, but with an hostile or negative attitude towards religion which they receive at school. The book which is least read and least known in Russia is the Bible. The intelligent young guides who took us through the Hermitage in Leningrad and other art museums, these young guides were well informed about the secular paintings of the world's great masters which are hung in these galleries, but were at almost total loss to explain those masterpieces whose characters or episodes derived from the Old or the New Testaments. We attended services in a Greek Orthodox church in Moscow on a Sunday morning. It was crowded with some 1,500 worshippers. They stood closely packed and reverently joined in the chants of the beautiful and colorful ritual of the Greek Orthodox Church. We saw practically no young people among them. In the evening of the same day, we attended a Baptist service. And here again, the church was packed, and the service of song and prayer and sermon was very impressive. There were some young people to be seen in this congregation. but bearing in mind the paucity of churches which are still functioning in these cities of millions of inhabitants. The number of the worshippers in these churches should not mislead anyone. The relentless anti-religious indoctrination which the children and the young people are receiving, and the fact that church attendance is definitely not a recommendation for advancement anywhere in Russia, but a sharp liability, makes one feel that the future of the church and the mosque and the synagogue in the USSR is dismal indeed. But religion in the past has shown remarkable recuperative powers under the most unfavorable conditions, and the deep mystic faith, which is a heritage of the Russian people, may yet break through the shackles of the present time. I attended Shabbos morning service in the Moscow synagogue in the company of the Israeli ambassador to the USSR. Here too the synagogue was filled, but again with elderly people. The service was impressive. There was a good cantor. I was honored by being given maftir, and I chanted immortal words of the prophet Isaiah in a land which was resolved to make their people, to make its people forget them. Only this one synagogue, which I attended, and two other very small and dilapidated Bate Midrash, like those which used to exist in the shtetl long ago in Eastern Europe. Only these synagogues exist in the whole of Moscow, a city where live close to 500,000 Jews. There is only one synagogue in Leningrad, a city of 300,000 Jews, and one in Kiev, a city of over 100,000 Jews. It's interesting, on the wrought iron gates of the beautiful synagogue of Leningrad, which was built before the revolution, one can still read the Hebrew inscription from Psalm 90, Shuva Adonai Ad Matai, Samcheinu Kimot Initanu Shnot Rainu Ra'a. Return, O Lord, how long? Make us glad for as many days as thou hast afflicted us, for as many years as we have seen evil. And there seemed to be something of a hope and a wistful prayer and a prophecy in these words of the psalmist. No instruction in Judaism, in Jewish history, or literature, in Hebrew or Yiddish, is allowed anywhere in the Soviet Union. A small yeshiva was recently opened under the supervision of the Moscow rabbi to train rabbinical functionaries for the Jewish community of the Soviet Union. Some 10 students are enrolled in this yeshiva. Hebrew prayer books, Bibles, other ritual objects, such as the scrolls of the Torah, Hebrew calendars, are very scarce indeed. The Soviet government has not permitted the printing or the importation of Hebrew books. Now, as individuals, Jews have equal rights in the USSR with all other citizens. would be untrue, however, to say that all anti-Semitism has been eradicated there. This would be, I'm afraid, a utopian assumption, even for the United States. Cases of discrimination have occurred and do occur. Officially, anti-Semitism is outlawed in the USSR. But practice, as we well know, does not always keep pace with what is written in the statute books. Anti-Semitism in Russia has had a long and dark history, and the October Revolution did not uproot it. The urbanized status of Russian Jews and their concentration in the large cities, their disproportionate numbers in the professions and key positions, their very ability have aroused, as was the case so often in the West, competition and antagonism, especially among the new generation of Russians who are now trained and qualified as they had not been previously for the very positions which Jews have come to occupy. Human nature has not changed much here as elsewhere. I was told that Russian Jews are being quietly pushed out of positions in the top governing bodies of the state and the Central Committee of the Communist Party, the higher echelons of the Red Army, the diplomatic services, and the higher brackets of academic professions and plant management. The conscience of the Russian intelligentsia on these manifestations of anti-Semitism in their midst seems to be troubled. Recently, the eminent young Russian poet Yevgenia Yevtushenko published an eloquent poem called Babi Yar in the organ of the Soviet Writers' Union. Babi Yar is the ghastly ravine outside the city of Kiev where 40,000 Jews, men, women, and children were slaughtered by the Nazis and their Ukrainian collaborators in the last war. Time and again, the Russian government was asked and did promise to erect a monument at Babi Yar, as it has in so many other places throughout the Soviet Union, to these Jewish victims. But nothing was done. Babi Yar is neglected and forsaken. The Jewish dead have no memorial. Yevtushenko, the poet, in his poem, Babi Yar, laments this tragic neglect, for he sees in it evidence of anti-Semitism, the same anti-Semitism which had plagued mankind through the centuries, and which he had hoped would never rise again in his beloved country, the International Union of the Russian People. I do not know how widespread this type of anti-Semitism actually is in the USSR today. Its existence is vigorously denied by the government. But cultural and religious discrimination directed against the Jewish nationality group as such is certainly being practiced. The fundamental law of the Soviet Union grants cultural autonomy and equality to all nationality groups in the Soviet Union, of which there are very many indeed. These nationality groups have a right to their own language, schools, press, and other cultural activities. This has been one of the honorable and proud boasts of the Soviet Union. Now, the Jewish group is recognized in Russia as a nationality, officially recognized as a nationality. Every Jew in the Soviet Union is required to indicate in his internal passport that he is a Jew, just as every Ukrainian is required to indicate that he is a Ukrainian, and every Georgian that he is a Georgian, every Armenian that he is an Armenian. But unlike all these other nationality groups in the Union, the Jewish group enjoys none of the rights of these nationalities. Because it is an extraterritorial community, so to speak. Because it is not centered in any one territory or region of the Union, like the Ukrainians and the Georgians and Uzbeks and the others. It has been denied these rights. Those who wish to enjoy these rights, such rights, it is argued by the apologists of the regime, should or should have migrated to the autonomous Jewish region of Birobidzhan in eastern Siberia, which the Soviet established. The argument, of course, ignores the historic realities of the Jewish position in Russia. Jews, though widely scattered over the country, always constituted a separate ethnic and cultural group in Russia, which even in the darkest days of the Tsars was free. Jews were free to exercise their religion and free to teach and develop their own Hebrew and Yiddish culture. And this argument of the apologist also overlooks the fiasco of Birobidzhan, which should have been foreseen. Nor were the motives which prompted the Soviet authorities in 1927 to set up Birobidzhan as an autonomous Jewish region. These motives were not bound up with the thought of stamping out Jewish cultural activities all over the rest of the Soviet Union, where Jews would remain in considerable numbers. Now, under Lenin, and for a time thereafter, after his death, Jewish nationality rights were not only recognized in Russia, but encouraged. The teaching of Yiddish and even of Hebrew was not forbidden. There was a Yiddish press and a Yiddish and Hebrew theater. And in localities where Jews were predominant, there were Jewish Soviets and courts of law whose business was conducted in Yiddish. There were Yiddish schools attended by tens of thousands of Jewish children. But under Stalin, these rights were brutally abrogated, and a campaign of persecution set in. All Yiddish schools and cultural institutions were outlawed. Yiddish writers were liquidated. Many obstacles were placed in the way of Jews who wished to practice their religion. Now, with the death of Stalin and his official downgrading at the 20th Party Congress in 1956, the situation eased somewhat. Yiddish writers who had been executed during the Stalin terror were posthumously reinstated. And some of their works have been recently published. Some of the works of Sholem Aleichem and Mendele Michel Sforim and Niall Peretz have also been published. I purchased in the principal bookshop of Moscow a volume of the selected works of the noted Yiddish writer David Bergelson, who had been liquidated under Stalin. It was published this year. Also a volume of the poetry by the Yiddish poet Asher Schwarzman, who died on the field of battle fighting as an officer in the Red Army. And a few weeks ago, the very first Yiddish periodical since 1948. A periodical which is to be a sort of a bi-monthly literary review made its appearance in Moscow. It has been an easing up somewhat, but much still remains to be corrected. I had occasion to discuss these matters at great length with some important Soviet officials, and in urging upon these officials of the State Committee for Cultural Relations with Foreign Countries, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and others, in urging upon them that a change in the attitude of their government towards the cultural rights of the Jewish group was in order, I drew attention to this inner contradiction which existed in their country, where on the one hand the works of Yiddish writers were being published, but on the other hand young Jews were not permitted to learn the language to be able to read these books. Why were they doing it? Why are they determined to consign to ultimate death the culture of this important nationality group within the Soviet Union? It was certainly not part of the basic philosophy of communism. Lenin, I argued with them, certainly did not approve of it. I furthermore drew their attention to the illogic of permitting services in Hebrew in the synagogues and yet making it impossible for Jewish children to learn Hebrew so that they may be able to understand these prayers. How would a knowledge of the Hebrew language, I asked them, how would a knowledge of the Hebrew language endanger the communist regime? Why should not the Jews of Russia enjoy the same nationality rights as do all the other nationalities? No more and no less. Certainly, they do not wish to give the world the impression, I said to these important officials, who listened very attentively. Certainly, they do not wish to give the world the impression that there exists a Jewish problem in the Soviet Union as there was in the days of the Tsars. Some of these officials, of course, gave me the official party line answers. No communist is ever short of an answer. But I got the impression that these answers were given without much conviction. I got the impression that further serious consideration is being given to this matter in the circles of the party. And I am inclined to the belief that further progress in the direction of granting the Jewish minority the same cultural and religious considerations which are accorded all other nationality and religious groups can still be made, given a friendly and insistent world Jewish opinion. I do not believe that Russian Jewry should be written off. It is true that many Jews in Russia have assimilated in the past 40 years, having been denied cultural and religious education, and having been cut off from contact with world Jewry. And in some instances, this assimilation was self-willed, quite eager. But many other Jews have remained, have retained an unshaken racial loyalty and an historic attachment, which, though not vocal, are strong and unmistakable. Many of these Jews are poorly informed about Jewish life abroad. They've been isolated so long. But they were eager to hear about Jewish life in America. And especially about Jewish life in Israel. They kindled at the very mention of Israel. When news somehow reached them of the rocket which the Israelis sent up, the Shavit, the comet, they greeted each other in the synagogues on Shabbos with a meaningful Mazel Tov. That's all. They said no more. We were in Moscow during an international film festival. Israel also exhibited. The evening when the Israeli film was shown, just a documentary about the progress and development of Israel, crowds of Jews milled around the large cinema. Thousands could not get in. Tickets were all sold and at a high premium. And inside the hall, the viewers cheered and applauded and wept. Last year, I was told, on Simchas Torah evening, the festival of the rejoicing with the law, in the street before the synagogue in Leningrad, thousands of Jews, many of them young Jews, danced and sang. There is still an unextinguished spark of Jewish loyalty among many of the 3 million Jews of the Soviet Union, which someday may yet burst forth into the brightness of a new day. Now, my good friends, let me summarize my general impressions about the attitude of the Russian people towards our country. What do the Russian people really think of us? Well, they are as confused about us as we are about them. I am not now speaking of their government officials and spokesmen. These naturally follow the official party line, and they turn on the spigot of praise or denunciation, frowns or smiles, as the political moment dictates. They are only a temporary barometer. Their endless propaganda has undoubtedly influenced the masses of the Russian people, but not to the point of automatic acceptance by all of all that has told them. Not all of them are quite that gullible. Not all of them are by any means persuaded, for example. They've been told by their propaganda that the American workers live in slums and on the brink of starvation, and that all Americans are race-obsessed, or that our people hate Russia and want war. On the contrary, they seem to like Americans. They are very friendly to American visitors. They harbor, I believe, a secret admiration for the great achievements of our country. They would like to do as well, if not better. Mr. Khrushchev cunningly plays upon this string. They know that the United States has never been at war with Russia, except for that brief, unfortunate archangel episode. And some of them recall the generous aid which America extended to their starving millions following the First World War, the Hoover Relief Committee. They remember, too, that we were their country's ally in the last war. They welcome most enthusiastically our artists and cultural emissaries as we do theirs. They want to live in peace and friendship with us. The people to whom I spoke, men and women in all walks of life, academicians, professional people, directors of factories and collective farms, working people generally, all expressed a most earnest hope for peace peace seem to be on everyone's lips. They know war. They know war far more intimately and tragically than we do. Our fighting front in the last war was thousands of miles removed from our homes. Their homes, their towns and cities and villages were the actual battlegrounds. And many of these towns and cities and villages were laid in ruins in the last war, and many of them have not yet been rebuilt. Russia lost over 20 million people in the last war. In Leningrad alone, 600,000 men, women, and children starved to death during the dreadful siege of 1,000 days. So the Russians are very sincere when they talk about peace and peaceful coexistence with the rest of the world. Their country has not yet recovered from the appalling ravages of the last war, and they want years of quiet in which to rebuild, in which to raise their low standard of living, in which to give their children a quieter and happier life than was their lot. Their leaders also want peace and coexistence with the non-communist world, but they have not fully thought through the implications of coexistence in terms of self-restraint, which they must come to exercise in foreign affairs, in terms of not fostering communist penetration in other countries under the guise of encouraging so-called movements of national liberation. As I told one of the leading academicians in Russia, you cannot ask for coexistence and in the same breath talk of burying capitalism. Mr. Khrushchev indicated a few days ago in his policy statement before the 22nd Congress of the Communist Party in Moscow that this is really the crux of the whole problem. He found it necessary to deny that communists had any right or desire to export revolution to non-communist countries. If this is so, and this is a radical departure in communist ideology, and if the West also will refrain from exciting or inciting counter-revolution in communist-dominated countries, and both East and West agree to channel their future aid to underdeveloped countries through the United Nations instead of seeking competitive advantages in these countries through such aid, then the way is open for real progress towards world peace. This last sentence is not Khrushchev, it's mine. But how far the communists are actually prepared to put their revised doctrine into practice has not yet been demonstrated. Nor are we ourselves quite clear in our own minds on this subject. The Russian people to whom I spoke, however friendly disposed towards us, are confused. They cannot understand us. Why, they ask me, why does the United States insist on rearming and reuniting Germany, their former deadly enemy and ours? Can these ex-Nazis, they ask me, who ravaged the world just a few short years ago, now be trusted? And should they now be rearmed to preserve the peace of the world? Why did the United States send the U-2 into the very heart of Russia at the very time when Russian leaders were on their way to a summit peace conference with the leaders of the United States? Why have we surrounded their country with military bases? Why, while advocating self-determination for peoples, did we finance and equip the invasion of Cuba? Why are we keeping Red China out of the United Nations and insist on the preposterous fiction that a defeated general on Formosa can speak for the 600 million peoples of China? Frankly, I had difficulty in answering these questions. And I assure you that I made every effort to answer them. I asked questions of them. Our people too, I tried to tell them, however friendly disposed they are towards the Russian people, are confused. They cannot understand the Russians. Why did the Soviet intervene in a most ruthless and bloody manner, suppress the Hungarian uprising? Why had their country signed a non-aggression pact with Hitler, thereby ushering in the Second World War, while rallying the whole world against fascists and Nazis? Why has Russia consistently refused to accept controls and inspection if it is really in earnest about disarmament? Why have they opposed a nuclear test ban? Why is the USSR putting difficulties in the way of the United Nations and keeping it from carrying out its legitimate functions? Well, they had difficulty answering these questions too. It was all done in a very amiable way. Confusion on both sides. And these confusions and misunderstandings are contributing to mutual distrust, and this distrust may get out of hand, even though basically neither people wants war. Upon my return to Cleveland on August the 10th, you may recall that I issued a statement to the press in which I said, we must learn to live on the same globe with the Soviet people and they with us. Neither they nor we are always in the right. The leaders of both countries must try to reduce tensions. The peoples of the world are waiting for signs of a new and inspired statesmanship both in the Kremlin and in the White House. The old is leading us nowhere, only from one crisis to another. Let us not be afraid to trade with each other in goods or in ideas. Let us compete in only one way. Which system can do more for its people? Certainly there are great differences between their system and ours. But these differences cannot be resolved by the sword. The problem before the world today is not which system is the better, but how the two can keep from destroying each other and mankind. Both systems are strongly entrenched and sufficiently powerful that one cannot destroy the other without destroying itself. The question is not then which will bury the other, but whether a war once unleashed between the East and the West will not bury them both. Now, was I exaggerating? 6 weeks later, the President of the United States addressed the General Assembly of the United Nations on September 25th and declared, Unconditional war can no longer lead to unconditional victory. It can no longer serve to settle disputes. Mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind. Today, every inhabitant of this planet must contemplate the day when it may no longer be habitable. Every man, woman, and child lives under a nuclear sword of Damocles, hanging by the slenderest of threads, capable of being cut at any moment by accident, miscalculation, or madness. The weapons of war must be abolished before they abolish us. We cannot expect all nations to adopt like systems, for conformity is the jailer of freedom and the enemy of growth. Ladies and gentlemen of this assembly, declared the President of the United States, the decision is ours. Never have the nations of the world had so much to lose or so much to gain. Together we shall save our planet, or together we shall perish in its flames. This was spoken not by a rabbi in a pulpit. This was by the President of the United States, who occupies the most responsible office in the world, speaking to an assembly of all the nations of the world. Now, if the President's solemn warning is not an exaggeration, then the only other alternative to annihilationist war is mutual accommodation. Now, mutual accommodation means give and take. Many of the differences between us will have to be left to the solvent of time. The two systems will certainly persist concurrently for a long time to come. This should be accepted as an axiom by this generation and the next and the next. Neither the communists nor we are getting off the globe. We must all therefore make every effort to free ourselves from the emotional climate of the Cold War. This, of course, applies also to the communists, for the Cold War cannot be ended unilaterally. As a people, I believe, dear friends, we should learn to live more wisely and less excitedly, and to act more circumspectly and cooperatively in world affairs, exploring every avenue of possible agreement, and bearing in mind always that we can never have it all our own way. As a rule, it is better to study our adversary, at times even to learn from him, than to abuse him. We should go about our national business without emotional tautness, certainly without self-righteousness, in the full knowledge that while the worst can happen, in all likelihood it will not, doing what we feel we ought to do at the behest of our own national traditions and principles, helping where we can, seeking no political compensation in return, craving no praise, deterred by no threats, looking first to the soundness and justice of our own economy and the well-being of our people. No one will rob us of our chosen way of life, nor will time rust our spiritual treasures if we cherish them lovingly.